We are in Joshua chapter 3 and 4 this evening. I think we should move through both of them. It's just a lot of details about the crossing of the Jordan, a few of the highlights. It's the entrance to the promised land after hundreds of years of waiting for the promise to be fulfilled. It is being fulfilled this evening with Joshua taking the people across. Now, we're going to have another mention of 3 days. If we go back, I think there's two periods of 3 days here. We had the first announcement in chapter 1 where they were sent out to tell the people, get ready in 3 days. And again, that can mean a period of time, you know, part of one day, a next day, and then the third day. And then now we're going to have another 3 days, and now they're going to say they're going to go to camp at the Jordan River, and they're going to go down there and camp for 3 days. And then on that seventh day, they're going to cross the Jordan River. And so that would be this day, which would be 3 plus 3 would equal then 7 days that we've got here. And that helps explain one of two reasons why the spies were in the mountains for 3 days. They could have left on this day right here, went across, and then hid for 3 days and came back and met Joshua at the Jordan River when they arrived there. Or they could have been sent out ahead of time before they made that announcement. So nonetheless, it all works. I think we've got two periods of 3 days. When we say 3 days here tonight, I don't think we're talking about this same exact 3 days here. So I think they're going to cross the Jordan on what would be the seventh day here. So here we go, chapter 3. It says, early in the morning, chapter 3, verse 1, early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. After 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp, giving orders to the people, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the priests who are Levites carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark, do not go near it. So what you have right here again is that basic setting. Here's the top of the Jordan, or the Dead Sea, the Jordan River. We're going to go ahead and put, you can see the map there on that on the notes. Shittim would be right about here, say 11 miles across. Jericho is here. Somewhere in here is going to be Gilgal, which is not going to be an actual city, but a place where they're going to end up setting the stones up. It's probably going to continue to be an outdoor sanctuary throughout Israel's history. We see in Hosea, they keep talking about Gilgal in the book of Hosea. The Jabbok River comes out of the mountains over here, the mountains of Jordan, as it rises out of the Jordan Valley. And there's many rivers coming through here, tributaries. And this Jabbok feeds into the Jordan River right here. And that's going to be important because right in here is going to be a city called Adam. And that's where the water is going to stop flowing when they come across here. So they've been here for 3 days, or Joshua says in 3 days we're leaving. Now they've left and they've gone to the bank of the Jordan, and they're going to sit there for 3 days and get ready to cross over. And the instructions are, keep your eye on the Ark of the Covenant, because when all of a sudden the moment comes when the Ark rises up and they start going into the river or towards the river, that's the sign for the people to begin to follow. And it's going to become a procession. And on the notes you can see, at the very top of the page, I just write this. Crossing the Jordan was both a ceremonial progression, similar to the religious processions of the time. What's taking place right here in our little, just our Bible account, just looks like they're going to go across the Jordan. But if you notice, it's very structured, it's organized. We're going to see there's going to be the armed tribes, the 2.5 tribes are armed, the ones that are staying on this side. Their families and property are staying back here, but they're going to arm themselves in groups, what is called of thousands. And the word thousand doesn't necessarily mean, you know, 1, 2, 3, 99, 999, 1,000. It means a group, a certain squadron that is organized for military movement. So again, it's translated a thousand, but it means just a squad. And they're organized in squads, military squads going out in front of the people. And so they're coming across armed. So it is both a military procession as they're moving into battle. It is also the movement of the God, or Yahweh, is moving, and he's the one that's going out in front, but he's going to be surrounded by military, and he's also going to be the one that's going to be conquering the Jordan River, which you see right here on point 3.8. Let's just go back to point 3.1. At Mount Sinai, in chapter 3, verse 1, it says, get yourselves ready or consecrate yourselves. If we take that to mean exactly what it meant in when they're at Mount Sinai before they met the Lord, it means they've got about 3 days to get ready. They're supposed to get their clothes washed. They're supposed to wash and abstain from sex during those days before. Now, one reason that could be important, and as I've read through some books about the Egyptian religion and Hatshepsut over this last year, it is amazing how sexual the religions are. The gods were always involved in some kind of sexual behavior. In fact, as we see in the Canaanite religions, as we come up into this religion throughout the time of the Old Testament, sexual interaction between the gods and the people, or between the prostitutes and the temple, and just, you know, a general mingling of you know, sexual behavior, was part of the religion. Any time the people encounter the Lord, sex is to be something they abstain from. Again, not saying that sex was bad. That's not the indication. The point that I've begun to kind of understand possibly during this last year is that the other religions had sex so entwined, ingrained in the religion, that God is making it, there's a boundary on this side and this side. Nothing to do with Yahweh involved any kind of sexual practice. I wasn't saying sex was bad, but it's like, do not confuse Yahweh worship with Egyptian worship, Canaanite worship, or any of the other gods. There was no sex involved. In fact, 3 days before, don't even engage in it. I want it that far away from me. I think that's really has something to do with the fact that when it talks about consecrating itself, it involves sex. Also, this I mentioned that this was a ceremonial process, a military process, and I do have a point there I got out of one of the commentaries, one of the archaeological books that gives some background, that there is, and it gives you the whole write-up in this book, that the Hittites had instructions on how to surround the king when he was going out to battle, and how many people would be, when the king would be brought out in his chair, he'd be carried out, that the men would be in certain formation, the soldiers, and they would surround him. And he was always, whenever he went out to the people to make judgments, he was always surrounded, like basic bodyguards, but was full military formation around the king. And so you see that besides the ceremonial procession, the military procession, you're also going to see the Ark of the Covenant is going to be surrounded and protected during this whole time. And the people are told, stay away from it. This is, again, giving the impression, this is the great king, that's in the ark. This is the great God that's going forward. And this is actually a military endeavor. The next point, on point 3.8, rivers, of course, provide boundaries. And this was a boundary. This provided a boundary. Rivers are always providing boundaries wherever they're at. They are a natural source of boundaries. In this world, they were considered divine. The rivers like the Nile River was recognized as being some kind of divine presence. Mesopotamia, the rivers were divine. So it would be normal to think that this river had some kind of divine presence. That would be fit the culture. Gods in all these cultures could make the rivers either reverse directions or could cease the supply. That's why, like the Nile, the flooding of the Nile, they're always trying to appease the gods. So they had a flooded Nile that would then bring the soil up. They'd have a fertile land. In Joseph's day, we talked about the 7 years of famine. It was probably a time that the Nile didn't flood and the soil was not renewed, and so they didn't have good crops. And so the gods were always involved in the flooding, the flowing, even the reversing of a river. And, for example, the Babylonian god Marduk, that's the chief god of Babylon, maintained the flow of the rivers. I mean, they honored him as the one that kept the rivers flowing. Now, what Yahweh's going to do right here is just trample on all of that. But what is going to take place right here is clearly a trampling. Number one, if this is a boundary, Yahweh's going to approach it and cross it. It's like he's not going to respect the boundary. If the river is divine and the river is some kind of a god, he's going to block it way up here when he wants to cross it. He's going to just cease the river's existence. And he is the god who stops the river. So in other words, he's got the power, not the other god, not Marduk. And he's going to override any kind of the control of the god. So I've got that as the next bullet point. So this river is very important in their culture, And remember, Jericho is watching this. They're observing this. And they can see the people come up. They can see the camps over here. They can see the people begin to move. And all of a sudden, the river stops flowing. It's Yahweh just kind of demonstrating both to the enemy, but also to his own people, these other gods are not the real gods. He is the true God. That's again, very clear on what's going to be taking place. Again, another point, when we see the Jordan River today, there's places where it's I don't want to say it's not impressive, but when I saw the Jordan River, you're used to seeing like the Mississippi River, or you're used to seeing rivers that are larger. When I saw the Jordan River, it's like, this is it. One of the things that is taking place, and that is causing the Dead Sea to dry up on another whole note, the bottom part of the Dead Sea is dwindling, and the coast is going, it's decreasing, because there's so much irrigation coming off of and damming of the river. The water is being used by Jordan and Israel, and there is negotiations back and forth on how they're going to use the water or preserve the water. And the Dead Sea, that's a consideration, because as the coast sinks or decreases, pockets of like salt and the new coast, it's caving in. And there's been roads that, because the water's decreasing, they're just collapsing. There's just the earth is collapsing underneath us as it decreases. So that's all things that are taking place in the modern world. But going back to this time, this would have been during the flood season, and I think I've got numbers written down. Yeah, at 3:15, chapter 3, verse 15, the flood stage came after the winter rains and in the spring harvest. And this is right around April is when this is taking place. It's right at the time of the Passover, when the Passover is going to be prepared. The maximum levels would be 80 to 100 feet wide. Again, that's not, you know, crazy wide, but it's 80 to 100 feet wide. And the depth would be 3 to 10 feet. Again, it's not like ridiculous deep, like deep sea deep. But again, 3 to 10 feet deep is what it would be at this time during this flood stage. And as it moved down here, it would get narrower and narrower as it moved closer to the Dead Sea, and would become more turbulent because it's moving, starting to move faster as it gets pulled into the Dead Sea, the Jordan River. There is a thicket around this area. As they approach this right here, Jeremiah talks about this also, or God talks to Jeremiah about it. In this area here, it's thick, so you can't just walk up to it and it's like this river right here and just kind of step out into it. They would have to cut their way through the thicket to get to this river at that point because of the brush that's growing up around it. And also, we're going to read this next. There's a city of Adam right here that's 17 miles away from Jericho, about 16 miles directly to the Dead Sea. So if the percentage is, if the water is going to stop right here where it's going, that's where it's going to stop flowing. It doesn't tell us how it stopped flowing. But basically, Yahweh is going to stop 29% of the total length of the Jordan River is going to be stopped. So about, you know, you could say roughly a third of the Jordan River is going to just come to a stop because of this event right here. This has happened during this, up in this place right in this area. The banks are steep. There's a lot of soil on the banks. And there is, you know, activity, like, you know, the plates are moving at different times. And so because of the steep banks, because of the turbulence of the geography, the plates, it's easy for this to cave in and stop the flow. In fact, there's three dates that are given here. In the year 1267, it was observed that it caved in and the water stopped flowing at Adam. In 1906, it stopped flowing right here at Adam in this area. It caved in. And the last time was 1927, where there was some kind of turbulence in the soil, the banks, it caved in, and it stopped flowing for 21 hours in 1927. So the Bible does not say the banks caved in. It says the Lord stopped it from flowing. But understand, that is something that has happened, and it does happen in this area. It's no different than the Red Sea parting, and it says right in the text, it says not just that the Lord parted the Red Sea, but a strong east wind came along. And so you can see God using nature to do it. But again, the timing is everything, because this is going to cave in when the priests step in the water. So it's not like they're standing going, I don't know what we're going to do, and all of a sudden some weird thing happens. They go down and they step in the water, and upon their arrival, the water stops flowing. So this is all prepared. Well, let's go back to the text and read this. They've in chapter 3, verse 1, get ready. In 3 days, we're going to be crossing. So they've moved down, and they're camped there for 3 days. He gives them directions, stay here and consecrate yourself. Get ready and keep watching, because when the ark moves, we're all going to be moving. Verse 5, Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. So that's going to be the seventh day. The spies are back by this time. It's the seventh day. They've been here for 3 days. They waited 3 days here, 3 days at the Jordan camping. And he says, tomorrow is the day. Joshua said to the priest, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on ahead of the people. So they took up and went ahead of them. Now, Joshua's going to be telling the priest when to move. He's going to actually be the one that tells them to move out of the Jordan River. He's going to be giving these directions. So they took it up and went ahead of them. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. That's what God tells Joshua, that you're the leader. You start giving directions. You start acting like I'm going to be working with you. Tell the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river. Now, there's going to be something that's going to take place here with these. There's going to be 12 stones, the 12 stones that are going to be set up at Gilgal. Gilgal, the word Gilgal, it means circle or the place of the circle. It is likely that, again, this is, you're kind of making assumptions here. Gilgal means circle. They place the stones at Gilgal. It would appear that it all is going to work together. They went somewhere and formed a camp, and where Joshua had them set the stones, they set them down in a circle, and that camp became known as Gilgal, the circle of where Joshua placed the rocks. He could have placed the rocks over here, or wherever, and that's where Gilgal would have been. It's not like they went to Gilgal, meaning Gilgal wasn't there until they put stones there, and that became Gilgal. That's one way of considering that, that they're going to set their camp up and where they place the stones. Now, these stones are going to be taken from the bottom of the Jordan River. And as you read this, there, especially as you study it and look at it, it is possible that Joshua, they go out there, and Joshua is going to actually take 12 stones and set them somewhere for the priest to stand on. And then when it's time to leave, the men are going to pick up the 12 stones and carry them up here. So where the priest stood on the 12 stones is where are the 12 stones that are placed right here. So they are from the bottom of the Jordan, but they were the actual stones the priests were standing on. Now, again, it's not clear. It's not, like, explicit that way. The priests are going to stand on a solid place. They're going to be standing somewhere solid in the Jordan River, holding the ark while the people pass by, and they move quickly through the Jordan River. And then there's going to be 12 men that are going to be chosen by Joshua, who apparently are standing off of the sidelines waiting for all this to take place so they can pick 12 stones up and go do it. So you're going to see him choose 12 men, and then at the end, the 12 men that he's chosen are going to pick 12 stones up and go. So the priest could just be standing there, and when Josh says, okay, grab 12 stones, they just grab 12 stones, and they're going to carry them on their shoulder. They're not taking up small stones. They're taking rocks on or stones on their shoulder. The idea there is that they're going to be smooth because they've been in the bottom of the Jordan for centuries, and they're going to be clearly river rock, meaning they've been smooth, not going to be jagged rocks from mountains or some kind of a desert area. They're going to be smooth, but they're going to be large enough that you couldn't just swim down and grab it and swim back up with it. Like, you can all go out and pick smooth stones up, but you can't pick this up off the bottom of the Jordan because you've got to carry it on your shoulder. So there's only one time in history, theoretically, the point is, that these stones are going to be able to be moved from the Jordan River up to this place. That's when the Jordan River had stopped and they were standing on it. So again, as we read this, consider these stones, because they're going to become a reminder that this is going to mark this event. But also, as we're going to read into chapter 4, the children in future generation ask, what are these stones about? Why, Why do we keep going here for Christmas? Why do we go here for Thanksgiving? Why does Grandma always make that? Why do we shoot fireworks off on the 4th of July? Well, let me tell you why we do that. Why do we gather around these 12 stones? Well, that's a good question. These 12 stones are, and then here comes the story. Now, on page 2 of the notes, this was common, the stones. At the very bottom of page 1, it says standing stones are frequently used as memorials in the Old Testament. You can see Jacob on his way to Mesopotamia. He stopped and he stood a stone up where the Lord appeared to him at Bethel, the house of God. He called it the house of God because God appeared to him there. So there's many times stones are stood up as memorials. And so on the page 2, there's the first point there. There are 142 independent sites, not 142 stones. There's more stones than that. But there are 142 sites, ancient sites, in the Negev. That's down here below west of the Dead Sea and going down, the desert area here, and on the east Sinai Peninsula, over here on the east side of Egypt. There are 142 locations, independent locations with standing stones, and they are from the time of Joshua and centuries, even millenniums before. So people have been standing stones up for many years as memorials. Here is two pictures of that I've taken. The one is at Gezer. Gezer is located right about here. Where's Jerusalem? We say Jerusalem's right here. Gezer would be roughly right about here. It's one of the cities that Solomon built the gates at. He built gates at Megiddo, Hazor, and Gezer as their fortified cities. It was a city that the Pharaoh gave to Solomon as a wedding gift. The Pharaoh came in and torched the place, took it from the Canaanites, and gave it as a wedding gift to Solomon. So that's Gezer. Nonetheless, at Gezer, in one of the higher parts of the tell at Gezer, you can still see this. What it is, no one knows for sure. There's standing stones. Those standing stones, you can see the memorial stones that are standing there in that picture. They're tall. They're like, taller than, I don't know, how tall would you say they are, Tony? You stood by them. They're taller than we are. They're like, if I'm 6 foot, they're 8 foot, the taller ones there, for example. And they're rough cut. They're not like the remains of some kind of a monument that they carved it out and they've worn away. But they are very uniquely long, and they've been standing there. It's possible they are something the tribes came together, the 12 tribes. There may have been 12 originally standing there, and the 12 tribes made a treaty there. But it's possible that they go back even before that time period, back to the Canaanites. That box that you see in the middle, that's a square stone with a carved out hole in the middle. There's nothing there. But most likely, that had a cover at one time. Like the Ark of the Covenant is covered up with the mercy seat. You've got the box made out of acacia wood covered in gold. But then on top of it, you've got a covering. That solid gold was called the mercy seat that was set on. So you could take the cover off and look inside of the Ark of the Covenant. You could see the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. You could see the jar of manna. And then you see Aaron's rod that budded, the three things that were kept in the Ark of the Covenant. So obviously there would have been a cover, not obviously, but most likely there would have been a cover of some sort on this square box. And there would have been probably some kind of a covenant. Whatever those stones represented, if it was tribes coming together or Canaanite nations coming together, or some contract or covenant with some deity, that would have been the contract, a copy of it would have been in that box, then covered up with some kind of covering. And that still stands there. Everybody that goes to Gezer takes a picture or something of that, standing by it or whatever. It's still there today. And it's amazing. It's just standing there, and it's like, it's just an example. Below that is at Shechem. And this is where Joshua's heading next. Joshua is going to cross here. They're going to camp at Gilgal, take Jericho, go up to Ai, and then from there they're heading up to Shechem to renew the covenant. We'll read about it here in a little bit. You'll probably see this picture again. They're going to go to some kind of an outdoor shrine somewhere to Shechem to renew the covenant. It is likely this is the place they went to. And on the left, you can see Mount Gerizim. And on the right, you can see Mount Ebal. And then there's a valley in between. Now, you can see the modern buildings there today. It's settled, and but there still remains. You can see the Old Testament city wall there that is in Shechem. But nonetheless, remember, the people are going to stand on Mount Gerizim, or they're going to stand on Mount Ebal, and they're going to read the curses and the blessings of the covenant back and forth. So they renew the covenant. So this is, and again, this is going to come up in the book of Judges also. Right there, Baal Bereth. It's a temple fortress, and we're going to come back to this place in the book of Judges. But you see the standing stone; it's broken off. You can see it right there, and you see the wall that was supporting it. So there was something up above. There's a temple standing there, a fortress there around it. But that was the standing stone. That standing stone may go back way back into the days of Abraham, even the days of the Canaanites before Abram, but it continued to be used. A lot of times the places that were used for holy places where the gods would appear, that is where God would appear to Jacob or Abraham. For example, Mount Moriah, that was clearly a place of worship in the days of the Canaanites. When Melchizedek was there, that's where Abram went with Isaac to Mount Moriah. That's eventually where the Ark of the Covenant is going to be set on the stone, and the temple is going to be built. So a lot of these holy places were recycled. They were then, this was some of the Canaanites came to, and then it was then used by Abram, and God appeared to Abram there, and it became a holy site. And then it reverses out, just like Gilgal is being established tonight by Joshua as a holy site, an outdoor shrine. By the time we get to the book of Hosea, we're reading that on Tuesday nights, in the 700s, Hosea is saying, stop going to Gilgal. Don't go to Bethel. Stop going to these places, these holy sites, because they've now gone pagan. And so you can take a pagan place, and you can see, you can't say, well, you could never use a pagan place for Christianity or Yahweh. I mean, it happens all the time, where pagan places were then converted into churches. But then after the Muslims came, they took the church and turned it into a Hagia Sophia, the big in Constantinople, the huge church, a beautiful church, all Christian. When they took Constantinople, it became a mosque. And so again, these things are coming and going. So nonetheless, there's a standing stone there at Shechem that may date way before the time of Jacob. That was probably where Joshua went to. It's going to be used during the time of the judges. But then when the prophets start saying, stop going to these places, it's because they've now been completely perverted and back into pagan worship. Anyway, those are standing stones, and that's no different than what's going to take place here. And let's go ahead and keep reading right here. So that's just kind of where we're heading, some more information.
Are those 12 smooth stones still around?
Good question, and that's in the notes here. This is a place, they've got several locations. I'm not sure if I give you the number. Gilgal means circle. Okay, yeah, the site is open air. The very last bullet point, this site has not been located. There are several tells or possible locations. Now, tells would be actual cities or villages that, that they collapsed in on themselves and then were deserted. And then dirt settled in, and other people maybe settled on top of them. And so there's a mound there. So there's several tells that are possible locations that they say this is Gilgal, this could be Gilgal. People make their best guess, but none of them are verified as for sure. But one very likely idea is kind of what I'm saying, is this was not a city. It did not become a city. It became a shrine, an outdoor shrine, kind of like what you see right here. Maybe at Shechem with this, except it just was just the stones. Maybe they had some temporary tents set up for services or to if the crowd came out. But most likely, there's a good chance it's not even, you can't even find it anymore because it was just an outdoor shrine. Those stones have been buried. It'd be And again, how big are those stones? Those stones are not as big as Gezer, obviously. But they would be big enough to be noticed for several centuries. Even the book of Joshua is going to say here, it's still there to this day. But no, Gilgal has not been found. We kind of, even as you put it on a map, you're kind of just kind of like putting it somewhere in this general area, but no one knows for sure. Okay, so the priests are going to go down into the water, and that's when the water is going to stop. That's where we're in chapter 3, verse 7. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of Israel, so they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses." And that's to give them confidence. That's not to make Joshua a great man. It's to let them know, Joshua is your leader. I'm working with Joshua. "Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." And that's then. So now they're going to do, when they do what Joshua says, God responds. So there's going to be God giving directions. There's going to be Joshua giving directions. There's going to be people obeying Joshua. And when the people obey Joshua, God responds. "Joshua said to the Israelites, 'Come here and listen to the words of the Lord.'" Again, notice if you have an NIV, that's all capital letters, L-O-R-D. So that's, "Come listen to the words of Yahweh, your God." Yahweh, your Elohim. "This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you." And now he names the nations that are here in the land. And again, we've looked at some of those locations or where some of these people are. Some of them have spread up further north and outside of Israel territory, but there are some of these tribes living down within here also. And this is, he says, this is going to be a sign. When you see this happen, you know that this God, Yahweh, is greater than any boundary, any God, any control these people have. Your God is greater than their gods. "And he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth," again, not just the Lord of, he's emphasizing here, he's not just, it's not Israel's God going against these gods, it's the God of all the earth going in here with Israel. All these people could come to the Lord, just like Rahab has come to the Lord. He's the Lord of all the earth. These others are imposters. They're not just the creations of people's imaginations. They are rulers and authorities in heavenly places manifesting their powers here in this earth. And now Yahweh's here to take dominion in this area because he's taken this territory. "Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe, and as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap." Now, in the parting of the Red Sea, the waters put a heap on both sides. If you saw the movie Ten Commandments, you saw, and that's exactly what happened. And then the wind would have dried out the path they crossed on dry ground. Here, it's going to pile up in a heap, and it's actually going to be some 17 miles from Jordan that's going to pile up in a heap. But the timing is going to be as the priests step in the water, then all of a sudden, so it would appear that this stoppage would have had to take place earlier than the time they stepped in, because they're not going to step in there and then stand there and wait, or maybe they would have. It appears that when they step in, the water's going to stop flowing. And we'll read on. "It will be cut off or blocked." The word "cut off" in the NIV, it's also going to be translated "blocked," which kind of gives idea here that something caved in and dammed it up here. "So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them." So the priests began to move, and the people they're all ready to go. They've been waiting. They begin to move out with them. "Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest." This is the harvest season. It even is recorded in the archaeological remains of Jericho. "Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan." And you can see on your notes, again, on the very first page, there's a map. Adam is right here where the Jabbok meets the Jordan, right about here, in an area called Zarephin. And Zarephin is this area right here. So this would be the area. This would be the city that it's located at. And they do know where that's at. I think I might have at. Do I have that written down here? Today it's called, do I even have that? I know I typed it in here somewhere. Yeah, today it is Tel Ed Damie, D-A-M-I-E-H. On these, so they know where this city of Adam is at. And again, in Hosea, it's interesting because we're going to come up to this word right here. This word Adam is going to come up because Hosea is going to mention Gilgal. He's going to mention Adam along with Because at first when it talks about Adam, in the verse we're going to be, we won't get to it tomorrow night, it's going to, are you talking about the man Adam? But it's a location. It talks about where Adam, and it's going to be talking about this location. It's going to be referring to some of these places, even in Hosea, as we get into that this next week. But nonetheless, they broke camp as soon as a place called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, or the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. And again, remember, Jericho can see this. They're not just like oblivious to what's going on. They're watching these people come to camp. They're like, how are they going to get across? All of a sudden, the water stops flowing, and they just walk across. It's like, what kind of God do they have? Remember, this could be recognized as a divine being. Their gods control the water, and now that water just stopped, and they walked across, which means our gods are doomed. I mean, they can't even control the water. They just stopped the water and crossed over and violated all the boundaries. Their God's not even interested in boundaries in this case. And was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan. And again, that's important where it says, stood firm on dry ground. While Israel passed by until the whole nation had completely completed the crossing on dry ground. So again, remember, they're supposed to stay 1,000 feet away. So you're going to have the Ark. They're going to be going on both sides, and standing in the middle is the Ark with the men standing around, you know, as some kind of the 12 men around it, or even some of the military standing around circling it, and the people are passing by just like a military procession, just like some kind of divine procession. And while God is demonstrating his authority over all the gods of this pagan land. And all the people crossed over. Chapter 4, verse 1. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, Yahweh said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan. Now again, you see right here, it's as if there, it's like choose 12 men. And again, you've got to decide, were those 12 men already chosen and were waiting? Or is that as the people are going up, it's like, hey, send me 12 guys. Yeah, Bill, Bob, come, we need some more guys down here. I think it's more than that. I think these 12 guys were chosen ahead of time. They may have been involved in standing around the Ark. They may have even been there waiting for the priest to move and take the 12 stones. They're not just random all of a sudden choosing 12 guys, as because everybody's already passed over. So these 12 guys would have to be chosen ahead of time and likely standing there waiting. Again, you can read it and put it together, but it's a very serious thing here. This is one of the highlights of this whole deal, is these 12 stones and the 12 men from each of the 12 tribes, which the 12 tribes has got to represent the unity of the people and the fact that God is working for this people, doing amazing things, and they're going to be brought up here to remember, this is the fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham. This is the place we're supposed to be. This is what God is doing for us. We belong here. And you can say, well, the political opinion is this. They're saying this. It's like, no, it doesn't matter. These stones are an indication. And again, I've heard people say this before. A lot of times in your life, you should put up signs. This is now becoming pastoral, so be careful. Is in your life, you look back, and every once in a while you look back and you kind of, am I in the right place? Am I doing the right thing? There comes times in our lives where you can put up a signpost that's like, no, I know that I'm at the right place, doing the right thing at this time. And sometimes you got to say, you remember that, because now you start living another month, another year, another 10 years. It's like, did I even do the right thing? You go, wait, I remember at this point I had three choices, and choice one and choice three were a bad choice. I chose the right choice, so I'm at the right. You put up signposts in your life. And that's kind of what this is. It's like a signpost that no matter what happens after this, they're always going to go back to Gilgal. After Jericho, they go back to Gilgal. After Ai, they go back to Gilgal. Because after Jericho, it's like, yeah, we're in the right place. Exciting, because they're victorious. After Ai, it's like, what? Did we make a mistake? Even Joshua is going to throw himself down on the ground in front of the Lord and said, you know, what? I thought you were going to help us out. Why did you do this? And God's going to bring him back to this. No, you're in the right place. Something else went wrong. You are not in the wrong place. You're not the wrong leader. You're not following the wrong God, taking the wrong land. Something else is wrong. So it helps you check off. Is this what? No, that's not what. That can't be wrong. This can't be wrong. It's got to be something else. And so it kind of becomes a signpost for them that they know that they're in the right land. no matter what takes place, they can come back here and regroup around that. Chapter 4, verse 2, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood. Now again, does that mean right where the priests were standing, or does it mean like just around where the priests were standing? Again, one way or the other, it could be that these stones were set up by the 12 men. Moses kind of organized it, put 12 stones, and made some kind of a platform. It doesn't say that specifically, but they were standing solidly, firmly on some, you know, what it says, dry ground, and then take those 12 stones right where the priest stood and take them out. So again, that would be a little more dramatic if it was the exact place that they were standing on these 12 stones. But it doesn't say that explicitly. But the best, at least, is this: priests were standing here, and then as the priests left, they grabbed some 12 stones kind of in the general vicinity from the bottom of the Jordan River. Choose 12 men from among the people, from one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. Again, is that place located already, or is it wherever you decide to stay tonight? Put that down, put them down. And I like to think of it as they haven't got reservations at some hotel somewhere. They're going to come across it. Well, let's camp here. Well, okay, put the stones down. The guys are finally been carrying the stone, you know, for 5 hours. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites. So he'd already chosen them. One from each tribe, and said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder. So now they're in the vicinity. They're near the Ark of the Covenant. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of Israel, of the Israelites, to serve as a sign. Here's what it's all about. To serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. And again, there you go, right there, forever. It'd be nice if we could find those 12 stones, because it's still not the end of forever. It'd be nice if they were still around. But again, it's going to be used for Joshua and his people, because they're going to go back to Gilgal to remember these things. But even in the future, the children will be asking, what about? So clearly, God has every intention of this becoming not just a place for Joshua to camp, but a place that they're going to come back annually. They're going to come back frequently to this place. So it's in his mind, it would appear that he's got an intention of this becoming a sanctuary of some sort. And there are going to be several places of remembrance. There's only going to be one, you know, temple in Jerusalem, but this would be the place where in the future they'd be able to come back and remember. So God has that right in the beginning, that this would be a place that's going to be something they're going to come and visit and remember. And again, by Hosea's day, it had been overrun with pagan idolatry and wicked practices, including prostitution or temple prostitution. And so Hosea says, "Don't, no more. Stop. If you're a believer in Yahweh, stop going to Gilgal." And that's a very interesting concept. You've got these holy sites that God is setting up, memorial places, but there's going to come a time where the prophets say, no, it's time to stop going to these holy sites because they're perverting. They no longer are representing Yahweh. Oh, they may use Yahweh's name, but that is not Yahweh's teaching there. So it's interesting. So the prophets are kind of running contrary to the culture, the traditions. Memorial to the people. Verse 8. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. That's an important line. They're obeying Joshua, which means as they obey, they're going to continue to see God work. They took 12 stones. Again, they repeat it again. We're going to say this several times. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of tribes of the Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to their camp, where they put them down. Again, you can see this is important because it's being said several times, and it's not just saying, and the stones, but they tell you 12 tribes, one from each of the tribes of Israel. They put them down from the Jordan, put them in the place of the camp. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priest who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood. So now it's becoming more detailed. This is it just the general location, or is this where they stood? And also the men carried them, and then it says Joshua set them up. So there would have been some, you know, they would have carried them and put them down like, you know, unloading a Home Depot truck of supplies, and then they would have been put together in some formation. Not that Joshua himself moved them, but Joshua then gave the directions on how this structure was going to be built, and most likely it was a circle. So Joshua's overseeing this because they know they're going to be using it in the future. And it was probably set up in some formation, some spacing that would be conducive for a worship service. I mean, was it a large circle? Was it a tight circle? Were the stones touching? Were they spaced out so that there'd be room for things, decorations, you know, relics in between the stones? Joshua is now organizing the setting up of the stones, and it would continue that way. Now, the priests who carried the ark, verse 10, remained standing. I read that, directed them. Everything had been, or where was I? It stood, and they are there. Okay, I'm going back to verse, put them down. Okay, verse 9. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests had carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day. Now, when was that added? There is room in this book for Joshua to have recorded these things, and then an editor to have come back and added things to it. Maybe if Joshua's saying that, he's saying, now, 7 years later, they're still here. That could be Joshua. Or it could be Samuel added something. Like even in Samuel's day, they were still there. It could be sometimes someone goes, how long is this? If this goes all the way up to the days of the prophets or the days of Ezra, the return from Babylon, and they're still there to this day, that it could be that. If they're, again, some people say the whole Bible was written in the Babylonian exile, even fabricated in the Babylonian exile. I think there's nothing wrong with saying it was brought together, it was organized, maybe even edited. Things were added, notes were added into it. But to say that it was written at that time. So you can see right here, if this is Joshua writing and they are there to this day, that would mean he had to write that within, you know, 7 years of this event. Or he could have written this detail down and then someone else came back and added to it, you know, what was said. And I don't think that's attacking the integrity of Scripture any more than Moses writing the first five books of the Bible using existing documentation and then just kind of sewing it together into a format. One thing I am not a minimalist in the sense it was all just fabricated. Now, the priests who carried the ark remained standing in the middle of the Jordan. Now, we're going to go back to the Jordan now again. They stood standing there until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people. The people had all crossed. The men had all grabbed the stones. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over armed in front of the Israelites. So now you find out that the first people, right, the ark goes down and the priests, and apparently right behind them is going to be the 2.5 tribes that don't have their possessions because they're leaving their possessions on the other side. They're coming down fully armed for battle. So now you've got not just a ceremonial procession of a god, but you've now got a military advancement coming in with the God. And so the 2.5 tribes come in. And it tells you about that right here. As Moses had directed, meaning Moses had told them, you've got to lead us into the Jordan. You've got to lead us into the promised land. And then after the battles, you can come back. And it points it out right here that they are obeying. And then verse 13, about 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. So they're coming across in war. And that word thousand means more like a military squad, whatever was that. It's an unknown number. It doesn't mean 1,000. It means 40 of these right here, 40 of these squadrons of these soldiers armed for battle. If it's 10, if it's 100, if it's 25, if it's 1,000, that's what it means. It doesn't mean 1,000. It means this body of men in squadron formation. Before the Lord to the plains of Jericho, for now we're clearly coming across in war formation. So the first people coming up out of the Jordan that Jericho sees is the military. And then there's a vast group of people coming behind. That day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel. The water stopped when the priests got there. And when the priest came up out, the water started flowing. The 12 stones were set up, and everyone's going, ooh, ah, God is with Joshua. Again, they were told this, but this is the first time Joshua has operated without Moses being there. Now, he's been the leader. He's been giving directions, but nothing miraculous has happened. Just him telling him a lot of directions. It's like, when are we going to know? Well, now we know. This is something that Joshua did without Moses. Just as they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. And again, that was an important point right there, because now they know we've got our next Moses. Then the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests carrying the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. Now it's important for this to be done because God says, tell them. So Joshua gives the command, they obey, and things start to happen. And the priests came up out of the river carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. No sooner had they set their feet on dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal, the place of the circle. I've got a note written in my Bible right here. Ehud sees these in Judges 3:19. So we get to Judges 3:19 when Ehud is moving across. He's the left-handed judge. He moves across there. He stops at the place of the stones. He stops there. So we'll see this again. When we get to Judges, these stones are going to pop up a couple times. But it says right there, on the 10th day of the first month. Like, this is the same day that they're commanded in, is it Exodus, to begin preparing for the Passover. And so this is, you can see right where they're at. They're right there ready. And they're going to celebrate Passover here at Gilgal. Camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho, and Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones. Now, have we not said that already? But here they're saying it again. It's the emphasis is here that Joshua set these stones up here at Gilgal. And he said to the Israelites, that we're going to end this whole night by saying it again. And he said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just as he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of Yahweh is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. It's to announce to the world that Yahweh is powerful, and that you may know your God, that He is with you. So this is, again, that's what this circle of stones is for the people. It's for them to remember. Then they have a doubt. If they forget, come back here. This is where they came from, that this is not just a mere story. I mean, in a sense, in my mind, these 12 stones are right here. Is for us, this is the Word of God. God hasn't handed us 12 stones. He's handed us this text of Scripture. It's verified through history. It's verified within itself. It's verified by archaeology. We can have it verified in our own lives taking place. And when you have a doubt, it's like, are we sure? You go back to Gilgal, the place of the circle, which in our case is not some kind of a ritual place. It is the text. It is the Word of God. This is the revelation. And this is solid, and this is true. And so that's why it was set up. The whole chapter is, yeah, it's the entrance into Israel, or into the land, yeah, Israel, into the land of Canaan. But it's also about getting these stones as a memorial, because what we're concerned about is not just that day. We're concerned about the future generations that this day happened for. It happened for the future generations. And if you forget why you're here, you forget how you got here, we just have always lived here. We're just like the Canaanites. You are not just like the Canaanites. You crossed over here to drive out the Canaanites. God, are you sure? Is that just Joshua's idea? No. God stopped. You didn't find some secret way in or wait until the water was, you know, dried up or something. You came across during flood season at God's time to the right place. And so that ends that chapter right there, chapter 3 and 4. And now chapter 5 will begin. Now when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites, until we had crossed over, their hearts melted, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. They, if they believe in, and they do believe in their gods, everybody believed in their gods, they trusted their gods, but they just saw Israel's God dry up all the power of their gods. And it's like, we thought it was over before, but now we've seen for, we've heard for 40 years, we've heard about the Red Sea, but now we've just witnessed the Jordan. It's like, this God is true. And so then you can see what takes place. And notice this right here in the NIV as we read this. The Lord had dried up the Jordan, chapter 5, verse 1, before the Israelites until we had crossed over. And that's one of those indications that this is written by Joshua, or at least someone that was there with Joshua, one of the elders that is writing this, because he was part of it that crossed over. It's most likely Joshua. The Jews always held that Joshua wrote this. So he is the one that's writing this, but that doesn't undermine the fact that you could maybe have someone coming back and detailing it, updating it, so people can continue to understand it. And that would be until this day. Does that mean Joshua's day, or does that mean someday in the future? So there's nothing wrong with that. So next week we'll take on chapter 5, because they're going to celebrate the Passover. They're going to go ahead and circumcise, so they haven't been circumcised in the wilderness. They're going to do that, and then they're going to go to Jericho. I will pray, and you're free to go. Thank you for being here. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We thank you that we have the scriptures as our place of the circle that we can come back and find remembrance. We also thank you for these things that have taken place in history. And ask that we again may walk confidently, knowing that you are still moving, still fulfilling your promise, still bringing about to pass the things that you guaranteed were to take place. Father, we know that we are in the middle of what you are doing, and ask that we would be able to continue faithfully serving you at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.